Welcome to Through Science to Health, brought to you each month during the noon hour when we bring you discussion and updates surrounding the pandemic and review some of the insights and discoveries surrounding COVID-19. This month, we join Dr. Joseph Mattern, Jefferson Healthcare's Chief Medical Officer. Dr. Mattern is also charged with overseeing the distribution of COVID vaccines for Jefferson Healthcare. Dr. Joe Mattern, thank you so much for joining us here on Through Science to Health.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
Always a pleasure. Why don't we start out with a bit of a recap? How does this last year or more look to you in retrospect?
Well, we could probably answer that with one word, which is blur. I'm sure I'm having the experience that many of your listeners are, which is some things seem so long ago and yet seem at the same time to be like that was just yesterday. For the hospital, we began this year of 2021 with a bit of hope, right? Because if we think about where we were about a year ago, we were waiting for vaccinations to arrive as a step towards solving the pandemic, to getting to the other side of it. At that point, it was really all about trying to isolate and use these different layers of protection. And so masking and closing businesses or capacity limits. So we had all these public health measures, which were, if we remember, really had worked effectively to, you know, stem the tide on the pandemic. But to get closer to the life that we all know, vaccinations were really what we needed to get to. And so lo and behold, we started the year with not having as many vaccines as we wanted, but, you know, able to begin to roll out what has turned out to be a really incredibly effective and safe set of vaccines, first with Pfizer and the Moderna and then the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And we've rode now, I think the last year was probably the ups and downs of learning, you know, how real life effectiveness of the vaccines works. And then going through different phases of the pandemic of feeling like, hey, you know, we're taking our masks off, we're getting back out there, and then, you know, watching another surge of cases and watching Delta variant kind of move through the summer. So I think that probably what most people are feeling is a bit of the yo-yo effect.
I know, it's sort of like a hey, whoa, right. Hey, whoa.
Yes. Right. You know, I think I try to sort of step back and remember that compared to where we were in the very beginning, we are in a much better place. I mean, we think about where schools are open, businesses are open. Yes, there are still masks in place. Yes, there are vaccine issues to deal with, mandates and, you know, access to certain things for people who are vaccinated and whether you can work or not. And so these conditions are in place because we can't let our guard down completely because this is still a very dangerous disease. And, you know, at this point in the pandemic, we still have a sizable portion of our population who are very susceptible to disease and susceptible to very severe disease. And so as we close out the year, we again have a few things to be hopeful for, some new medications that are on the horizon and ability to begin doing booster vaccinations, but also the rollout of vaccinations for a larger group of children who are part of that sizable population who can still get the disease and spread the disease and get very sick from the disease.
Yeah, with the children, now that means logistics once again, doesn't it?
It is. A couple challenges here. I think when the vaccine first rolled out, because we knew that there was a very high-risk susceptible group and that the vaccine would be offered to, the interest was stronger and it was more palpable. We were seeing people with chronic health conditions and older people being hospitalized early on and making up such a large number of cases so that when we knew that the vaccines were targeting that group in the beginning, we knew that there was going to be uptake and interest. We've known that children don't get as severely sick as frequently as older individuals. So we knew that when we got to the point where the vaccine was available for them, we knew that the hesitancy that existed, you know, even with the adult population would probably increase with the pediatric population. I think we're seeing that. Logistically, there is the other issue, of course, similar to what we had before, which is how do you get the vaccine out to a large group of people in a short amount of time to try to meet the demand? Vaccinating a child feels different for most people than vaccinating themselves. They need to maybe have more questions answered. They need a little bit more time. They feel maybe more secure having that vaccination done in a medical office compared to, you know, the drive-up model that I think many of us have become familiar with and actually really appreciate and can work for the pediatric. But it's similar challenges we've had before, but maybe a little bit more increased in intensity. How about that?
Well, the parent-child relationship, right? You can't get around that.
No. And I think, you know, I've always talked to parents that vaccine hesitancy for children is not new, and particularly in our community. And it's been something that I've been talking to parents about for a while. And I've always tried to keep open communication and let folks know that I begin with the place of assuming that the parent has the best intent for the child, that they're trying to make the best decision with the information that they've got, and they're trying to understand, and they want to protect the child and have them be healthy. And so I think it's no different now that we've got the vaccination for children. And I think that there's a lot more misinformation. Unfortunately, parents have to wade through these days to get to the place where they can feel secure. But it's important for parents to understand that this is a time when we are still in a pandemic, where the virus that is causing this pandemic is likely going to be with us for several years or more into the future. This is a virus that will circulate at some level through our country and the world for some time to come. So the question becomes, at some point, you or your family members are going to come into contact with the virus. And the question is, what layers of protection do you have when you come into contact with the virus? And so as social distancing and at some point maybe mask wearing goes away as, you know, cases go down, we're left with the immunity that we have. And we can either have some of that immunity through having had infection and having survived infection, or through vaccination. And when we talk about risks and benefits, a few reasons why, when we saw the safety profile come through on the vaccine for the 5 to 11 year old set, and we saw it become extremely effective vaccine from preventing severe illness and reducing frequency of infection, but also a good safety profile, again, similar to adults, which is, you know, having some, you know, soreness at the site of the shot and, you know, some fever and other symptoms that go away after 24 to 72 hours, that the benefit falls on the side of the vaccination, both to protect the individual, because children are getting sick from this virus. They are requiring hospitalization, sometimes directly from the effects of the virus, sometimes the after effects in the form of something called multi-inflammatory syndrome, which can affect multiple children. And we can't always figure out sort of why, which children are going to be affected by that, but can lead to hospitalization. And we're seeing children die at least at a rate that's similar to what influenza does to children in the year. And possibly in some cases, it's more severe. So there's the protecting the individual. There's also the understanding that these children are part of their community, they're part of their family, and that they also can spread the virus if they're sick. So even if they don't become severely ill, they can maybe infect a family member who does become more ill, or a friend or a classmate. And so we always know vaccinations have never been 100%. We've always known that if we vaccinate a portion of the population, that they won't develop the immunity that they need to fully ward off the infection. But we know that if enough of the population gets vaccinated, the disease will circulate at such a low level that you'll be protected just partly by the immunity of others. And so to get that, the children 5 to 11 make up a sizable part of our population. And those children are going to be more regularly in contact with family members and loved ones who are living with cancer or other immune suppressing conditions, and people who are living into their 80s and 90s. And it's important to remember that those could be important individuals in that child's life. And so there's another loss that people can suffer and have been suffering during this pandemic, which is the loss of loved ones. So stopping the spread of the disease is also not only to, you know, protect the child from illness, but also to protect them from the trauma of maybe spreading the illness to someone else who falls to the disease.
And for a child to have to live with that.
They know. I mean, they really do understand, and they, you know, particularly that age group. So I think that for them, certainly, you know, again, with their individual protection, but also that sense of that I'm part of the solution, that they want to be part of that. And the other thing to keep in mind is that we don't know the long-term effects of the virus 5-10 years later. There's a lot of focus on the long-term effects of the vaccine, and people worry about that. But really, history tells us that if you don't have an adverse effect early on from the vaccine, that after the first 2 months, and I can't think in my career where there's been proven to be something that happened years later from the vaccination. But I have plenty of examples of diseases that come back to cause problems later on. So varicella, the chickenpox virus causing shingles years later, the herpes simplex virus that causes cold sores recurring over and over again, the HPV virus, which can cause warts but can cause cancer. It's very understandable to be nervous about, what will the vaccine do years from now, but point it out to people that we know there are people who are still suffering 6 to 12 months after they've had the virus. And sometimes they just don't have their sense of smell, but some of them are dealing with fatigue and cardiac issues. And so we don't know what that group of folks are going to look like 3, 5, 10 years from now. Still, prevention of the disease is the best option.
Brings to mind the reality that there are breakthrough cases. And maybe we could talk briefly about that.
Early on in the pandemic, when the vaccines first rolled out and the initial data with the vaccines, we were kind of really over the moon because early on, there was a lot of expectation setting of saying, hey, probably the vaccines won't work to stop infection altogether. What we really need to do is to stop severe disease and stop people from dying from this virus and maybe turn it into just a common cold. So when we, initially saw the results of the first round of vaccinations and we saw that, hey, we're actually stopping people from getting infected altogether, and people who were vaccinated started to take their masks down, and that was the pre-Delta variant. And that was also early on in the immunity with the vaccine. And so we saw two things happen. We saw the Delta variant take hold, which tends to lead to exposure of a lot more virus because of the way that the Delta variant replicates. Also facing the fact that we do see some waning immunity from the vaccine. Now, the fact that people have a little weakening of their immunity over time and that people will get some symptoms or get COVID infection despite being vaccinated does not mean that the vaccines are not effective. In fact, that's been shown to still hold up, is that we decrease hospitalizations and we decrease deaths. For the more susceptible population to severe illness, meaning older individuals, people with immune compromising conditions, they're the individuals who most need a booster to protect them from more severe illness. Because when we've seen breakthrough infections, people who have been vaccinated who get infected, the vast majority of them have mild illness and don't have serious complications, don't end up in the hospital. For the small percentage of folks who do get more severe infection, it's people who are older, it's people who are in frail health, people who have immune compromising conditions. And so that group, it's particularly important to boost their immunity with booster doses, or in some cases that their first series has to be 3 shots instead of 2 shots. So that's part of that recommendation when we saw the rollout. Part of the debate about whether everyone should get a booster vaccine initially was because we were still seeing the intended goal coming true, which was people who were vaccinated were not the ones who were filling up ICUs and hospital beds. And so the question of, does everyone need that? But now we're at a point with the boosters where it's likely going to be recommended that everyone take a booster, partly for the vaccinated portion of our population to basically double down on their immunity to both reduce spread and reduce the likelihood of breakthrough infections that potentially could lead to more severe illness. But the breakthrough infections and breakthrough cases that we see, again, vast majority are not severe illness. The vaccine is still holding up and doing what it's supposed to do, particularly the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines. A little less effectiveness with the Johnson & Johnson, and that's also part of the reason why there's a recommendation for folks who have had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to consider using one of the other vaccines as their booster shot.
Dr. Fauci mentioned a little bit of a warning that the vaccine's waning immunity combined with the highly transmissible Delta variant will make for a double whammy that will impact even the vaccinated people. And he's talking about going into the winter season. So how do you envision the hospital managing this upcoming season? What are your expectations?
I'm going to anticipate that the FDA approved booster doses for all people who got the Pfizer vaccine. So I'm going to anticipate that what we will be doing is seeing a recommendation to quickly follow from the CDC that we will provide booster doses to the vaccinated population 6 months after their last dose. So I think that's one part of it is, so that fights the waning immunity. What he's describing is essentially what happened during the summer. So, it's kind of the, double whammy round two is what I would say. But particularly with people gathering indoors more, family gatherings, holidays, people have put off some of these things for a while. So this is the first chance for some people to get back together. So there will be more travel. There will be more people getting back together. So I think the things that we're emphasizing are go ahead, get your booster dose, also get your flu vaccine, because we've already seen flu cases starting to come back because schools are in session, people are traveling. So we don't need to have a breakout at the same time here as people are gathering and doing all these things. So that would be the triple whammy, maybe, adding a flu on top. The other thing that is on the horizon, which gives us a little bit of hope, is that there are two medications, one from the company Merck, another from Pfizer, that are oral medications that can be taken early in the course of illness and that have the initial results that they are touting decrease hospitalizations and deaths pretty considerably. So we may have a new weapon as we kind of hit this period as well. Those medications could be authorized for emergency use by the end of the year. I know the government has already purchased and they're already beginning to send out. So I'm anticipating the approval. And I think that's going to be probably an important tool because the monoclonal antibodies that we use now to do that role are injections or IV infusions, and they're a more complicated administration and coordination. This would be just picking up 5 to 7 days of medicine at your pharmacy and taking it home. And so it'd look much more similar to what people are used to with influenza, if they get influenza and they've ever taken Tamiflu as a flu medication. So it should be similar to that. So I think that we're certainly at risk. I'm going to guess that we're going to see the numbers, but I think it's important to understand that we will continue to see cases, but the question is, what do you have for hospitalizations? And so, I look at Iceland as an interesting country because it is a more highly vaccinated country. I think about 85% of their population is vaccinated. What's interesting is they've had very few deaths and their hospitalizations stay down. And that's probably the new norm. Probably the place where we land ultimately is that we become less focused on COVID case counts and we become more focused on the big distance between COVID cases and how many people end up in the hospitalizations. And what we really want to do is increase that gap because we don't have enough yet. People will talk about places being highly vaccinated, and you could say Jefferson County is highly vaccinated, well, comparatively to other counties in Washington across the country. But if you look at us and say, well, 70, 75%, it still means one quarter of the population is not. We're kind of a good example. And then, there's other places where, it's 50% or less. So until we get to that point where we get enough immunity in across our population, we're still going to have folks at risk. So between vaccinations and maybe some of these new treatments, we'll be able to get to the point where COVID cases will be around, but life goes on and hospital beds don't fill up.
Speaking of administration and managing, how's the hospital doing?
Yeah, the yo-yo that we talked about in the beginning, I think people have grown tired. It's a difficult time, and I think it's important for the general population to know that the hospital experience that I think many people, and I'm not just talking about Jefferson, I'm talking about kind of all over, before the pandemic, kind of what you got used to as far as access to care and how long it takes to get an appointment and what your medical teams can accomplish for you, it's different now. And it's going to be different for a while and for a couple of reasons. One is that staff turnover is a real thing. We consider ourselves fortunate when we compare to other places, but we've lost staff to early retirement, people who've just decided they're not sure they want to do that, or they've pared down their schedules because they need to balance family and other priorities. And on top of that, the work that we are doing, even for non-COVID patients, is that, there's a lot more people who are struggling and suffering. And we talked early on about care that was put off or delayed. We're still seeing the effects of that. We're still seeing a lot of people struggling with mental health. When I'm not in the hospital doing my leadership bit, I'm in the clinic seeing patients and taking care of folks. And I can tell you that there's a lot more on everyone's plate when they come through the door to see me. And so I spend a lot more time always spent a lot of time talking to people about their mental health. And I think it's only increased, particularly in younger, kids and adolescents, a lot more difficulty for that group. We're seeing a lot of folks who are coming in who've, you know, maybe missed some follow-up blood work or other test results. And so we're really kind of diving deeper into their history. So I find myself taking longer to get through each patient, and we've got less staff. So it's taking longer to do things like get people scheduled for maybe a study in the radiology department, or it's taking longer to get back to someone about a medication refill or a question that they've sent in. The teams here are doing the best that they can, but folks are pretty tired because they work the pandemic and they live the pandemic when they leave the walls here. And you're seeing it across healthcare. The thing I would kind of say, which I kind of talked about in the very beginning of the pandemic, which is that we really need a lot of compassion and grace to go around to everyone, not just to healthcare workers, but to everyone, because it's always been a difficult job, but it's never been harder.
Well, I would say that empathy and appreciation for healthcare workers goes a long way. We just want to extend our appreciation to everything that Jefferson Healthcare has done. Dr. Joe Mattern, we'd love to have you back sooner than later. Dr. Joseph Mattern, Jefferson Healthcare's Chief Medical Officer, thank you so much for joining us here on Through Science to Health.
Thanks again, Chris.
Well, this has been another edition of Through Science to Health, our monthly conversation, bringing you insights and discoveries surrounding our journey through the pandemic. Until next time, this is Chris Bricker for KPTZ's Through Science to Health.